This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Of course, the season's changing. We're reminded that weather is capricious. We might, have something like winter here pretty soon, and we've certainly been hunkering down the last few days, but nothing like what people on the coasts of our country and other countries have had to deal with recently, with very difficult tropical storms, tornadoes, hurricanes and typhoons. Wherever you are in the world, this violent weather is noticeable. We're going to talk about that today with a couple of people with some experience in responding to nasty weather. Tim Wiedrich is the section chief of the Emergency Preparedness and Response Section of the North Dakota Department of Health. He joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Doug.
And by phone, Cliff Black. He is a member of the Medical Reserve Corps and also a flight paramedic for Trinity Hospital in Minot. Cliff, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tim, let's get a little background here. I mentioned the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. That's the national umbrella, right?
That's right. The 50 states began realizing that they needed to share resources, whether those are people or equipment, amongst each other during large-scale emergencies. And so there was the development of a compact that actually started decades ago, and each state then took model legislation and considered it, adopted it, and right now we have all 50 states in the country that are participating in this system.
Well, as the guy who's in charge of the state's Emergency Preparedness and Response Section, you oversee the North Dakota Medical Reserve Corps, which was recently dispatched to North Carolina. Tell us about the Reserve Corps.
Well, the Reserve Corps is about 1,000 medical providers and public health providers that have raised their hands within the state and had said, during a large-scale emergency, send me. And so these are primarily physicians, nurses, paramedics, EMTs, certified nursing assistants. But there's a wide range of other medical personnel as well, like phlebotomists and laboratory personnel. So this 1,000 group of medical professionals during a time of a large-scale disaster, either in-state or out-of-state, are solicited through an automatic call process to see if they're available to respond to whatever the emergency is and to accept the assignment from our Emergency Operations Center in the State Health Department.
Well, Cliff, how did you become a member?
I've been in EMS for going on almost 40 years and just looked for different ways to become involved with state emergencies and have known the people in the North Dakota Department of Health and made contact with them. And they said they had such a program going, and that kind of excited me. And that's how I got my start, going through their classes and their preparation and their training and me working incident command in several disasters. I kind of thought I'd get a good feel for this.
And you're a flight paramedic. Describe for our listeners what that means.
Basically, a critical care flight paramedic at Trinity Hospital here, working out of the emergency room at the hospital, 12-hour shifts, responding to medical needs of outlying communities, patients, different hospitals calling for our services, transporting by air critical care back to the hospital for further care.
So are you in the air most days?
Most days we average maybe 1 to 2 flights a day. We do a helicopter and also a fixed wing, so we're expanding quite nicely, about 150-mile radius.
All right. Tim, how do you recruit volunteers for the Corps?
Well, there are a number of ways. Word of mouth is probably one of the better ways, EMS providers, nurses, physicians, sharing the information, because prior to our having this program, which quite frankly got started after the September 11, 2001 attacks, when there was recognized nationwide that we did not have a good response to large-scale disasters and emergencies, there began a preparedness program across the country, and the idea was formulated to have each of the states develop this type of a model. And so we, along with the other 49 states, began developing the Medical Reserve Corps. And as we then proceeded with the development, we began making contact with professional associations within the medical and public health fields, began attending their conferences, setting up booths, doing public outreach such as this program so that people become aware of it and have the information as to how they can get involved as well.
Well, when a big storm event happens, like Hurricane Florence washes ashore in North Carolina, what's the process of getting somebody from North Dakota there? How are you notified and how quickly do you get there and all that kind of stuff.
The Emergency Management Assistance Compact is the mechanism that the state that needs assistance has a communication process where there's a specific state that each year is selected to host the communications. And so that's coordinated. Once a state indicates that they need the assistance, they then share that information through the communication system. All of the other 49 states are notified, and that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if a request goes out at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning, we get that request at that time and begin to act on it. If we have the assets, whether those are people or equipment, to respond, we then put together a response package to say this is what we can make available to you within the time frame that we indicate, and then the requesting state sees what's available to them and they'll make their selection as to who comes in. So part of this, to be a little bit more detail, is dependent on where the emergency is actually occurring.
Sure.
When we have hurricanes that we're responding to, and last year we responded to both Florida and Texas, you know, these greater distances here in the central part of the country, we're not typically going to be the first ones in. It's just we can't get there that quickly just because of the geographic distances. But clearly, when we have a neighboring state or someone that's within our region, then that response could be actually part of the primary response. What a lot of people don't realize is that long after the emergency is no longer on the news, the needs still continue to exist. The very first time that we did a major response was in 2009. The system had been developed prior to that. And then we had Hurricane Katrina. Was a major test. And as we actually ended up sending two different crews down there, it was a test of the system to see if the public health and medical portion of this was actually going to work. And I can tell you it worked very, very well in North Dakota. We had a strong medical response where we were able to send physicians and nurses. Unfortunately, we also had to send a body recovery team into that emergency as well for that very somber and sobering but necessary activity that occurred. Since that time, the system's been continuing to improve and grow.
Cliff, what sorts of operations did you conduct in North Carolina?
We were deployed to, with our 204 form, to go to Raleigh and meet the group of people there to get our assignment number. From there, we went to Greenville, North Carolina, to set up a convoy team of members that were going to end up in Wilmington, North Carolina. There, we were put up at a recreation shelter for our housing, and we got deployed to take care of a help with a hospital that had a level one trauma center that had discharged 36 patients that were located at a school, and that's where the shelter was set up. So that's where we ran our operations out of, taking care of 36 discharged patients from a level one trauma center.
So in this case, you were a paramedic, not necessarily flying.
Correct. I was part of the team of nurses, EMTs, paramedics. We had nurse practitioners there, and then all sorts of incident command people from the hospital supporting us, to logistics, to a daytime and nighttime supervisor of the shelter working under them.
Was there any unusual risk for you and your other volunteers?
The unusual risk would have been, you know, unforeseen weather coming in, you know, the possible of the flooding picking up. But we were at a pretty, we were basically at ground zero, but the devastation was not as great as it could have been, other than people losing their homes from, you know, the roofs being blown off, the rainfall. These patients had no place to go back home to, being discharged from the hospital. They needed further care, such as dialysis or post-orthopedic surgery patients, and that's what we did there.
Would you live there after you've seen what the storm did?
I would not be afraid to live there, because any place is as good as another is how well you prepare yourself.
We do have tornadoes.
To handle situations, yes.
Tim, who pays for all of this?
Well, it really does vary depending on the size, scope, and location of the emergency. So there are times, for example, when the Medical Reserve Corps is being sent out purely as volunteers and that there is no actual reimbursement that flows back. other situations where there is reimbursement available, then there can actually be the offset of the transportation expenses, some of the medical expenses, but also even salaries that are paid on an hourly basis. So there are a wide variety of funding sources, private volunteers donating their own time. At times, institutions will send people and cover their salaries. So that's another form. But in addition to that, there are FEMA reimbursements that are available to and local reimbursements that are available as well. It just depends on the emergency.
Well, it strikes me that another complication of this isn't just who pays for whatever, but it's the fact that you're taking people who have jobs and putting them someplace else. And so that does put that place they were working at a bit of a disadvantage. So how do you work that out?
Well, it really is a coordinated effort. In those situations, because the vast majority of the individuals that are within that 1,000 group actually do have employment. And so there's a process where we do the notification. They'll reach back to their employer, get permission whether they can or can't go, and then that helps determine whether there's availability or not. But beyond that, there's a lot of logistical issues associated with this. Unfortunately, the EMAC, or Emergency Management Assistance Compact, has worked that out in advance. So we know, for example, as a sending state, that we're responsible for covering workers' compensation for the people we send. In fact, we make them temporary state health department employees as part of the mission when we send them. We've worked out through the EMAC process the fact that the licensure issues for the medical professionals that we're sending are honored in the receiving state. So normally that wouldn't be the case, but because this is a disaster, that's worked out. And then the liability concerns are also worked out in terms of the requesting state or the receiving state is the one that takes on the liability that's associated with whatever the operations are. In addition to that, we've got all the travel considerations in terms of how we physically transport people into the destinations that the requesting state establishes. They'll indicate a staging area that we need to get people to. So if we can fly people in using commercial airlines, that's what we'll do. If we need to use private aircraft or even buses, that's what we'll do as well.
Cliff, describe how you worked it out with Trinity Hospital in Minot.
I'm kind of a unique situation where being a casual employee, or even if you were a full-time employee, you let your employer know that you'd like to get this time off. Sometimes we have to help, you know, find somebody to cover our shift, make sure it's okay with family, other co-workers, to be able to go on a mission like this. And they're very understanding because they realize that we're going somewhere unique in a unique situation to help others out. So it kind of looks favorable on their part by allowing us to get the time off and encouraging us to go to help others. So maybe we can bring something back to our community. So I found it, you know, fairly easy to get the time off, and so did most of the other team members.
In a sense, Tim, it's like paying it forward, I guess. How many people did North Dakota send to North Carolina on this particular mission?
We had 28 total. There were 18 of those were EMS providers, in other words, EMTs and paramedics, and then 10 were nurses.
And the whole time you're in the Emergency Operations Center?
That's right. We have a backup process because we need to provide the level of support that's necessary to maintain the operations there. The actual tactical operations are controlled within the incident command system of the receiving state. So things like the mission orders, what they'll be doing, which shelter they'll be going to, are actually assigned by, in this case, North Carolina. But in every one of those steps, there's a reach back to our Emergency Operations Center so that we can validate that these are appropriate things for our folks to be doing, that they're operating in safe conditions, that there's appropriate food and sleeping arrangements. Because remember, we're coming into very austere conditions. This is not necessarily even having hotel availability, having shower availability, all of that in these types of disasters may not be available. But there are certain things that we call wraparound services that just physically have to be there. Safety is paramount. We won't send our people into a situation that's not stabilized or safe for them to go into.
Well, Cliff, did you meet some other folks from other emergency operations when you were in North Carolina?
Yes, we met several different agencies, such as like the Florida strike team that brought up six ambulances to help with transportation.
Wow.
Other nurses and other EMTs from local ambulance services away from the hurricane activity. And they all pretty much have a system where that if they're needed, the resources can be called and mobilized. So, yeah, there were quite a few variety of we even had some swift water rescue personnel that their specialty was going into the flowing rivers. So everybody kind of had a mission, training, and assignments.
So did you swap adventure stories in the evening or whenever?
Well, yeah, it was pretty much long days, 12 to 14-hour days. Did have some downtime in the evening to, you know, have a meal, get a good shower, some rest, and then swap some stories amongst other team members and what they do.
Was this your first deployment by the North Dakota Medical Reserve Corps? Have you done this before?
I've done this before with the Reserve Corps in the past. I've also worked with another consulting group and do railroad derailments, other exercises in the communities, other disaster exercises. So it's kind of the more you do of these, the more they all come together.
Tim, you mentioned you've got 1,000 people that are sort of on a list for the North Dakota Medical Reserve Corps that you can call on. Do you need specific talents? And if so, how can people apply?
Well, a couple of things about that. One is that even people that don't have any medical training but have an interest in assisting can be part of the Medical Reserve Corps, because we have a lot of need for non-medical personnel to support these operations as well. So people that are drivers can do just general labor that may have other special skills in terms of languages and so forth are all welcome participants in this system. Anybody that has a medical license of any type is also welcome to participate in the system. And the best way to get involved is to either reach out to us by telephone or by website. Our website is ndhelp.org. That's ndhelp.org. And our phone number is 701-328-2270. That's 701-328-2270.
Okay, and that's ndhelp, H-E-L-P?
That's correct.
Okay, ndhelp.org or 701-328-2270. And what's expected of people who join the Corps?
Well, I think that in terms of the actual activities that they do, what we want from them is their full support in operating the mission. What I mean by that is that people have to be flexible coming into these emergencies.
Yeah.
And so they'll bring their normal skill sets if they're medically trained. They won't be asked to operate outside of what they normally do as a scope of practice. But in addition to that, you have to be very, very flexible in these circumstances. And what you can expect to receive as being part of this is a profound sense of fulfillment. Many, many people come back saying that their life has been changed, to be providing aid and care in those situations where people are at having their worst day ever, whether they've lost relatives or family members, close friends, or physical possessions. This is a very bad day for many of those folks.
Tim Wiedrich is with the North Dakota Department of Health. Thank you for joining us today, Tim.
My pleasure.
And Cliff Black is a volunteer with the North Dakota Medical Reserve Corps and a flight paramedic for Trinity Hospital in Minot. Thank you, Cliff.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, Tom Ezern.
Who defines what normal looks like? Psychologist Andrew Solomon's research of children diagnosed with deafness, Down syndrome, autism, dwarfism, and more challenges the dynamics of what a regular family looks like. You can meet the author of the book and award-winning documentary Far From the Tree on October 13th at the Game Changer Ideas Festival. More information can be found online at GameChangerND.com. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at BushFoundation.org.
Prairie Public's North Dakota U.S. Senate debate, scheduled for Friday, October 5th, has been postponed as senators must remain in Washington for the Kavanaugh confirmation vote. Prairie Public will reschedule the debate between Representative Kevin Cramer, Republican, and Senator Heidi Heitkamp, Democrat, for a later date.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for listening. History is comprised of stories, which, with context, help explain what happened in the past. Historians like NDSU Distinguished Professor of History Tom Ezern collect stories to help teach lessons about our heritage. Today, Tom's Plains Folk essay is titled Baked Ham and Memento Mori.
The wind may be daunting, but the sky is glorious as we arrive for the annual fall dinner at St. Benedict's Catholic Church in the old Wild Rice settlement of Cass County. The stunning twin-spired church is both a beacon and an adornment for pilgrims of an autumn landscape. We purchase tickets and await our turn to join the hundreds of diners. This is a fine fall feed featuring roast ham with cherry sauce, basically cherry pie filling with mustard in it. The dinner is distinguished by the offering of fresh garden produce, tomatoes, and cukes. You fill your plate in a serving line, and then parishioners deliver beverages and desserts and replace relishes at the tables. There are plenty of amusements in the church sanctuary while we wait for our ticket numbers, number 377 and 378, to come up for seating in the basement. We make the rounds of stained glass windows, each bearing the name of a pioneering French family, Savageau, Brunel. We enjoy polka music being delivered from the choir loft by musicians who have stayed on following the morning's polka mass. Oh, and yes, there's the skull. The mottled skull of Father Bernier rests on exhibit in a wood-framed cubbyhole set into the wall. The tablet beneath says he was born 29th of June, 1833, and died 13 December, 1891. He is buried outside. Only the skull is in the church. In the cemetery around back, too, are many historic cast-iron grave markers, many of them depicting two figures in adoration of a crucifix with a skull at their feet. Now, people tell you Father Bernier was killed by Indians, which did not happen. Newspapers routinely reported his passage in 1891, obviously of natural causes, and noted that priests throughout the region attended his funeral. Other than delighting people like me who have a junior high school sense of delight, what is the deal with the skulls at St. Benedict's? They are not an oddity, but rather a commonality of Catholic life and faith. They are what are known as memento mori, which is to say, reminders of mortality, admonishing us to remember that life is short, death near. An old painting in the basement is another sort of reminder of the vitality of this St. Benedict's parish in its heyday, likely the 1920s. The great church is painted yellow. The mansard-roofed rectory stands alongside. A thrifty orchard is geometrically perfect to the south of the church, and a general store stands across the road east. This is an exceedingly historic parish. It traces its origins to a mission founded by Father Jean-Baptiste Chenin, a noted frontier missionary, in 1868. In 1870 began a chain migration of Francophone pioneers from Trois-Rivières, Quebec, a movement led by the Cossette and Savageau families, who were the nucleus of a tight settlement of French farmers. Early churches were rude log buildings. The first resident priest, Father Athanase Fidèle Bernier, arrived in 1881. In 1884, a correspondent of the Wahpeton Times reported the growth and evident prosperity of the flourishing French settlement, whose inhabitants spoke little English but were successful farmers. Father Bernier said his church was packed every Sunday. So, in 1888, an impressive wood-frame church seating 300 was built. This was replaced in 1913 by the present church with twin spires. A reminder, then, as you make the rounds of fall suppers on the northern prairies, have yourself a fine feed, but also take the time to inquire about the rich histories of the people feeding you. They have much to share.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, a report about the growing number of women veterans who are entering politics. Sue Balcom joins us to talk about sauerkraut, and we'll share our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Another search is underway for the remains of a woman who mysteriously disappeared and is believed to have been murdered 23 years ago in northwestern Minnesota's Kitson County. 41-year-old Becky Jo Look was last seen in October of 1995. Sheriff Steve Porter says information received last week has focused on property that belonged to the stepfather of Christopher Nelson, who is no longer living. Several months ago, Nelson's mother told Porter that her son had told her he helped another man bury a woman's body in a rock pile. A search of one location in August did not find any human remains. Porter says the latest recent tip led searchers to the remote site east of Lancaster.
I got the information on Wednesday. I lined up a backhoe by Friday and Saturday. We had about 15 men from our local fire departments take time out of their day and come out there and search a wooded area. And we dug through probably 5 rock piles, and there's still more work that we can do out there. But it was just kind of interesting to have somebody call up and say no on land that Chris frequented and knew about very well. You know, he saw lights out in the field, and they shut him off. They tried to hide, and it's like, well, I think we can justify doing some digging out there with that in mind.
The tipster's information about the suspicious truck coincides with the time Becky Jo Look was last seen. She moved to Halma to live with her boyfriend. His whereabouts is not known, as he is believed to have left the area not long after Look's disappearance. The North Dakota Catholic Conference is the latest organization to oppose Measure 1 on the November ballot.
Yeah, this is a difficult issue for us because no one's opposed to integrity. But what matters is the actual language of the measure. And the actual language, we believe, is a threat to churches and charities.
Christopher Dodson is the executive director and general counsel for the conference. He says the measure would require the charities and churches to disclose the names of every contributor, even if a small amount of the contribution was used to influence government action or speak out on a ballot measure.
Churches and charities do not endorse or oppose candidates. They don't contribute to public officials. We're not big lobbyists, but they do engage in the public square and they do provide social services. This measure would sweep us in with all those supposed big corporations that are spreading money around.
Dodson says the conference is concerned that people could use those donor names for harassment. He says the measure, while well-intentioned, just goes too far. And law enforcement agencies in North Dakota will be stepping up enforcement against underage drinking in October. Ashley Doan is Safety Public Information Specialist with the North Dakota Highway Patrol. She says the Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign is part of Vision Zero, which aims to reduce fatalities on roadways all the way down to zero.
They will be looking to see, you know, for those teens that are trying to purchase alcohol, or if they are having parties, they will be looking for those more. They're also going to be going into some establishments and doing the shoulder taps and looking at establishments that sell alcohol and doing compliance checks with those establishments.
Doan says about 62% of North Dakota high school students report having had at least one alcoholic drink. She says it is hoped the enforcement period will help teens understand the seriousness of consequences of drinking and driving.
We want to really enforce the idea that, you know, underage drinking is a choice that can lead to making poor decisions, such as drinking and driving. And decisions like these can end in tragedy. So we don't want that to happen. So we do want to let them know that, you know, everything going on right now in their life, they don't want to miss out on those opportunities because of a poor decision.
The enforcement period will begin October 12th and end on October 31st. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A record number of women are running in this year's midterm elections, especially women with military backgrounds. You might think those candidates would play up their national security credentials, but as NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports, many of these women candidates are choosing to focus instead on their credentials as mothers.
Democrats are holding a rally at the fairgrounds outside Richmond, Kentucky. There's a long line for food, and a country band is warming up the crowd. The guy singing Margaritaville? He's the county jailer, running for re-election. But there's one candidate in particular that everyone seems to know. Amy McGrath, Democratic candidate for Kentucky's 6th District.
Awesome to be here tonight, Madison County. This is awesome.
McGrath is a veteran of the Marines. She's one of a record-setting group of women vets running for the House this year. This race is a toss-up, but it's a district that voted for Trump by 15 points. Incumbent Republican Andy Barr is pushing back by talking about his support of veterans. Female veterans like McGrath have had a remarkable ability to get attention this year. Women standing in front of fighter jets or helicopters have become a common sight in ads. Texas Democrat MJ Hagar talks about her helicopter being shot down and carries a toddler. A large tattoo which covers shrapnel scars peeking out from her shirt sleeve.
Injured and unable to fly, I was barred from my next career choice because I was a woman.
Hi.
So I came home. I worked in healthcare and business. I got married and started my family.
According to Amanda Hunter at the Barbara Lee Family Foundation, these ads show a shift in strategy.
Instead of trying to fit into an outdated template of what a candidate should look like, this year women are really running unapologetically as themselves. So really using their entire life experience, and that includes motherhood, time served in combat.
Hunter says voters sometimes penalize candidates who are mothers, wondering if those candidates can hold office while taking care of young children. McGrath saw it as a smart choice to bring her own motherhood into her campaign.
Look, there might not be a whole lot of people that really can relate to being a fighter pilot. Let's just be honest. But there's a ton of people that can relate to being a mom because I am doing it right along with them.
Frances Click attended that rally in Kentucky, and she said that she has veterans in her family.
I know the stress and the pressures that is, but her being a mother and juggling everything is more important to me because she understands what it's like.
It's not just about Democrats, nor is it just that women veterans are trying to show a softer side. In one ad, Arizona Republican Senate candidate Martha McSally used her military background as a way of casting herself as anti-establishment.
I'm a fighter pilot, and I talk like one. That's why I told Washington Republicans to grow a pair of ovaries and get the job done.
But what's happening with female veterans may be a part of a larger trend.
I would argue that candidates overall, not necessarily a gender thing, are being more real. And I would argue that that's something based on social media, okay? You know, people, the more authentic you are on social media, the more followers you have, right?
That's Missy Shorey, executive director of Maggie's List, a group that promotes conservative women candidates.
If you are just a canned candidate, where's the personality? Where's the belief? Where's the passion? Showing your tattoos? I don't know. Have you been to a water park? Everybody's got one.
Back at the rally in Kentucky, Navy veteran Gregory Tucker, a registered independent, says he'll support McGrath. Her military service is a factor for him, but so is President Trump's Vietnam draft deferment.
Well, my shirt says, all gave some. Some gave all. One had bone spurs. Veterans against Trump.
Like so many other House races this year, this one isn't just about the candidates who are in it. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
This story originally aired on NPR's Morning Edition. Next on Main Street, Sue Balcom joins us to talk about sauerkraut and Sauerkraut Day.
Programming is supported by the Fargo Public Library, presenting their Fall into Jazz concerts featuring local jazz artists. Concerts are Sundays in October starting at 2 p.m. at the downtown Main Library. More information at fargolibrary.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and Sue Balcom joins us from our microphone in Bismarck. It's time to talk about food.
And something that should be a North Dakota holiday is Wishick's annual Sauerkraut Day.
Hip hip hooray.
Hip hip hooray. Yeah, no, it's oh no, what is it? Oompa-pa. Oompa-pa hooray.
Oh, that's what the band sounds like.
That's right. Okay. That's right. And you know, those kids, they teach accordion down in Wishick, and those kids do a fabulous job
Love
of
it.
Entertaining at Sauerkraut Day, which happens to be October 10th of this year. So
we're talking about sauerkraut.
Yeah, and kind of like how that all came about. You know, they've done Sauerkraut Day as kind of like a thank you to their customers. The Main Street Chamber people got together and said, let's show our appreciation by feeding them some sauerkraut.
We've got some cabbage left.
Now that I say that out loud, it sounds pretty weird, but I think this is like the 93rd year they've been doing this. And so, you know, sauerkraut, of course, we talked about it before, about how important it is that you eat probably two or three times a day for vitamin C.
Oh, I am behind. I'm way behind.
You better get going. Yeah. And good gut bacteria. And then when you want to celebrate how healthy you are, you go down to Wishick's annual sauerkraut day.
And stand outside. Yeah.
And stand outside.
Yeah.
I'm kind of finally catching on what you mean by that. So,
Well, you gave us a little cheat sheet of notes from the 2016 celebration. 500 pounds of sauerkraut, 110 pounds of hot dogs, and 200 pounds of speck. I got to be honest, I don't know what speck is.
That's fat. That's little tiny pieces of fat that they float. And they're, you know, it kind of greases that sauerkraut up a little bit.
So they use all of the bacon, I take it.
Right.
Okay.
And if you've never had the opportunity to go to their secret garage where they have these guys with, like, pitchforks stirring this huge cauldron over this great big propane heater and this bubbling sauerkraut with all these weenies floating to the top in it, and then they load it up into coolers or big tubs and they run it over to the hall.
Oh, question here, Sue. How can that possibly be a secret in Wishing?
What's a secret to you people who aren't German?
I mean, don't they open the door every now and then?
They have to open the door.
It's like chemical warfare otherwise.
Well, and I don't know if they get a little high off the fumes or what, but, you know, I'm going to go down and check that out this year for sure.
But this is a family thing for you.
It is such a reunion for me to go down there in two respects. I can take a tour of the cemetery and get the history of my four generations of my family, which are Casemans and Meiningers. And then whilst you're standing in line, which when I went down there for the 90th, that line went all the way around the building for people waiting to get in and get their little plate of food. And, of course, I have like 13 aunts and uncles on my mom's side of the family and 8 on my dad's side of the family, and many of them still live down there. So I get a chance to see them and give them hugs, which is really un-German, but we're getting older now, so it's getting to be a little more acceptable.
So they're lining up for a plate that includes sauerkraut. What else is on that plate?
Mashed potatoes. You get a hot dog or two. You get a slice of bread. And for some strange reason, a slice of yellow cheese.
Oh, a little color on the plate. Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. That's maybe what it is. Because for years I'm thinking, where does this fit into German cooking? So
I'm stuck on the mashed potato.
Oh, stuck. I love sauerkraut and mashed potatoes. One of my favorite dishes ever. Add a little hamburger or rice to that whole combination there. Make a little casserole and eat it on top of mashed potatoes. Yum!
Sounds filling.
Hey, Fear Factor had nothing over on our family dinners, let me tell you. My kids, we have competitions at Christmas time where, like, my uncle will bring some pig's feet and my cousin will bring some pig's feet, and then we have liverwurst.
Oh, we got enough pig's feet. Yeah.
And then we got to sample it all, you know, and we eat sauerkraut and we eat prunes and we eat this food because we like it, not because we have to, you know. So my kids are just turning up their noses. So maybe that's why they have that slice of yellow cheese on that plate.
Yeah, you got to eat something because they're not hungry for the oink, I take it.
Right.
Well, and when you're at Wishick annual Sauerkraut Day, which again, October 10th this year, there's going to be lots of food. But is there something to kind of help you work that out? There's got to be some good polka dancing.
Oh, that's right. There's vendors down there. And, of course, then they have the kids, like I mentioned earlier, that still learn how to sing in German and play the accordion. And sometimes the St. Andrew's Church Choir comes. And that brings tears to my eyes because a lot of those people are related to me, but they sing all their songs in German. And they're getting a little old, and their voices are a little shaky, and they remind me of my roots and my grandparents, and it's very touching. So then we run on over to the church and have pie.
Well, duh.
Oh, right.
I mean, the heck with the dancing. The walk over to the church is enough justification to have any kind of pie that you can imagine. Sour cream raisin, lemon, apple, you know, coconut cream, rhubarb.
Is there good Bavarian cream there?
I'm not sure if Bavarian cream was something that the Germans from Russia even know about, but they might have a substitute like chocolate pudding in a pie shell. I don't know.
Yeah, they lived hundreds of miles from Bavaria, I take
right.
it. But you could tamp down the pie because it's on top of sauerkraut. This is an interesting combination.
It is indeed, but it's a wonderful little social gathering. They have coffee there. The money goes to a good cause, and it's just a wonderful cap for the whole day. oh, wait, before you leave, or maybe before you even go, you better stop at Stan's Supermarket because they still sell the best fry sausage in the area. And I'm sure there'll be people calling the station going, that's not true. The better stuff is at Napoleon or Linton. But yes, if you get to Stan's, pick up some of that fry sausage or head cheese or liverwurst and take that home. Take a piece of Wishick home with you.
Okay, well, what do you think is Stan's secret or the supermarket secret there?
I think that it's just an old recipe, and they're one of the few places that still make an original tasting German fry sausage. You know, like you couldn't – my mother used to work for Gackelpack, and they used to make a fry sausage and sell it statewide until HACCP rules were put into place, and then they couldn't do that anymore because it wasn't federally inspected beef. And so, you know, we kind of lost a few of those traditions, and that sausage is really a tradition. You know, they served at weddings. They serve it at any kind of party that you have. And my uncles all make really awesome German sausage, but they don't make it for the public. So if you want to have it, you got to go to Stan's or the Locker in Napoleon or the one in Linton to really get that old-fashioned flavor.
And if you want to get that old-fashioned sauerkraut flavor, I suppose you're going to avoid the Gedneys and the Franks, and you're going to what?
You're going to call me up, and I've got a vat brewing, and I got a couple quarts on my shelf, and I think you could maybe find good homemade sauerkraut at a farmer's market. And or you could make your own. You can make it in smaller batches. And it's really not much more than cabbage and salt and technique, which is pretty much what everything we do is, like simple ingredients, but it's the technique there.
We check in with Sue Balcom every week.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, guys. It's always a pleasure.
What's happening is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that's the question we ask every Thursday about this time. What is there to do this weekend, this fall weekend around the state of North Dakota? Ashley Thornburg and I have a couple of ideas.
And my favorite thing to do the first weekend of October is the Fargo-Moorhead Visual Artists Studio Crawl. This is a couple dozen artists who have opened up their studios that you can come and watch them while they are working, see how hardworking and talented artists really are and have to be to perform at the level that they do. So it's like a pub crawl. You know, you're familiar with that concept. You go from one bar to the next to the next. We'll do that with Artist Studios. It goes from noon to 6, both Saturday and Sunday. And you can just Google search Studio Crawl Fargo to get the map because they're kind of all over the place, these studios. So,
and as you mentioned yesterday, Knotstock is underway at Minot State University, and that's a big annual event up there where they bring all kinds of artists together from all kinds of disciplines, and it's free. People get to interact with the artists, see their work, and enjoy themselves on the campus of Minot State University. So if you're in that neck of the woods of North Dakota, the 4th through the 6th, Knotstock at Minot State University.
Well, and did you know that it is World Space Week?
No.
Well, there is an event on Saturday the 6th in Valley City at the campus of Valley City State University at the Rhodes Science Center. The United Nations declared World Space Week to begin October 4th and last through the 10th. This year's theme, Space Unites the World. And the planetarium is going to have a showing of the National Geographic presentation, Mars 2. It is free, and it gets going at 1 o'clock on Saturday the 6th in Valley City at the campus of Valley City State University, the Rhodes Science Center.
Well, let's talk about some music now. The Fargo Library's Jazz Concert Series is Sundays in October. It's at the downtown Fargo Library, the main library. You can celebrate Fargo's history of jazz and outstanding musical talent with the Fargo Public Library's annual Jazz into Fall Music Series. It features local musicians playing a wide range of jazz styles. The series starts this Sunday at 2 in the afternoon, again at the downtown library, with a performance by the Eric Martins Trio. Other groups scheduled, and these are all Sundays at 2 o'clock. On October the 14th, the Skipjacks. October the 21st, the John Peterson Jazz Quintet. And at the end of the month, October 28th, the MSUM Faculty Jazz Quartet. Again, all of these concerts at 2 o'clock, and the price is right. They're free.
There is an awareness walk this Monday, October 8th, in Minot at Minot State University. This is to remember missing and murdered Indigenous women, and this will be on Indigenous Peoples Day. That is on October 8th. Walkers are asked to meet at the Student Center on the campus of Minot State University to begin walking at 4 p.m., and the walk will go till about 5:30, and then you have the opportunity to hear from guest speakers who are very involved with this, and you can learn more during the awareness walk to remember missing and murdered Indigenous women this Monday on Indigenous Peoples Day on the campus of Minot State University, 4 p.m.
And starting tonight through Sunday in Williston, Entertainment Inc. presents The Little Shop of Horrors at the Old Armory. It's a delightful sci-fi horror musical. Seymour is a timid and dejected assistant at a floral shop who happens upon a strange plant which he affectionately names Audrey II after his crush. Little does he know that this strange and unusual plant will develop a soulful R&B voice, a potty mouth, and an unquenchable thirst for human blood. It's 7:30 in the evenings and 2:30 on Sunday. Again, it runs tonight through Sunday. Tickets are $10 to $20. It's The Little Shop of Horrors at the Old Armory in Williston.
I always wonder who wrote that and what sort of dental procedure they might have just been waking up from at the time to come up with that idea.
Yeah, well.
Well, also, The Foreigner is performing Thursday through Sunday, October 4th through the 7th in Grand Forks at the Fire Hall Theater. This takes place at a fishing lodge in rural Georgia, and there is going to be lots of conversation with, well, strangers and people from exotic foreign countries. And once they are all alone, well, that is when the fun really gets going. The Foreigner in Grand Forks at the Fire Hall Theater, starting today and lasting through Sunday. Hours for the evening shows are 7:30, and there is a 2 o'clock matinee on Sunday, and tickets are anywhere from $13 to $16.
Well, here's another show, Church Basement Ladies, Friday through Sunday in Minot. It's at the Arlene with Mouse River Players performing a musical comedy about the ladies that work in the church basement preparing meals for church functions. It's inspired by the book Growing Up Lutheran by Janet Letness Martin and Suzanne Nelson. Church Basement Ladies follows four Lutheran women as they organize the food and solve the problems of a rural Minnesota church undergoing changes in 1965. Ah, the good old days. It's 7:30 in the evenings, a 2 o'clock matinee on Sunday. The cost is $10 to $15 for Church Basement Ladies in Minot.
Well, we are going to tag team on the pick of the week, Doug, because it is Sauerkraut Days coming up in Wishick, and this is an event that Main Street is actually looking to go to. We're working out the details still, but it looks likely that we will be able to be there and broadcasting from Sauerkraut Days.
Yeah, it is. Downtown Wishick, which will be overpopulated on that Wednesday, October 10th, because that's when it happens. That's Sauerkraut Day. That's when they serve lots and lots of sauerkraut, lots and lots of wieners. There's dessert. There's German music. There's an accordion band. I mean, what more could you ask for?
I don't know. German desserts.
There you go.
Yeah, I want some of those.
All right.
For sure.
Well, we'll be there. Main Street is in Wishick, October 10th on Wednesday. Join us for Sauerkraut Day. That's what's happening.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck. Producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind farms in North and South Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 4th. North Dakota remembers World War I. 3 days after the drive for the fourth Liberty Loan began, on September 28, 1918, the citizens of North Dakota had subscribed to $12 million of the state's $19 million quota. But Liberty Loans involved redeemable bonds. Although the sale of bonds tied up personal finances, the money would eventually be returned with interest, and the end of the war appeared to be in sight. The Allies were driving the Germans back to and beyond the Hindenburg Line, but it came at a cost. Casualty lists were swelling, but this reality of war also spurred the desire for North Dakotans to donate. When the first combat death of a North Dakota boy was announced in February, the number of Red Cross members grew substantially. As a result, over $600,000 worth of goods was produced by North Dakota units of the Red Cross over the next 7 months. The escalating tempo of the war was rapidly draining the funds of the many organizations supporting the troops. With the fourth Liberty Loan drive nearing completion, organizations such as the Red Cross were planning to begin campaigns of their own. They desperately needed to solicit donations to fund their activities on the battlefields of France and in the encampments stateside. The people of North Dakota, like their fellow Americans, had been asked to dig deeply, including a recent campaign asking farmers to donate the yield from a number of acres to the Red Cross. The needs of all the organizations were increasing dramatically, while the ability of people to support every cause was decreasing. On September 5th, President Woodrow Wilson suggested that instead of mounting separate campaigns, the major organizations combine into a united war work campaign. Seven organizations, which together would make this united appeal, were the YMCA, the YWCA, the National Catholic War Council, the Jewish Welfare Board, the War Camp Community Service, the American Library Association, and the Salvation Army. Over $170 million were needed, and North Dakotans were being asked for $675,000, $1 for every man, woman, and child in the state. The new slogan was, "It can be done. It must be done. It will be done." Since time was needed to set up the combined drive, ironically, the kickoff date was set for November 11th, which would turn out to be the date of the armistice. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
So Heidi Heitkamp has a decision to make. Does she support Kavanaugh and prove she's on the side of the president and you?
In pro-Trump North Dakota, a Democratic senator up for re-election is under pressure over the Brett Kavanaugh nomination. Will she stay aligned with the president and vote to confirm the Supreme Court nominee? That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, news is busting out all over. We're working on that. And, of course, every Friday we talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, about the week's big stories. And we get another movie review from Matt Olean. And this Friday it'll be The House with a Clock in Its Walls. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.